Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm chatting with Angela Bassa. She's the Director of Data Science at iRobot. And how are you today?
I'm great, Scott. How are you?
I'm very happy to be chatting with you. I understand that you were just in Portland, but I missed you by a couple of weeks. What were you doing in Portland?
Yeah, so I was there for CSV Conf, which is a data science conference that's community run. A lot of folks talk about open data and the wonderful things they do with it. It was really fun.
Mm-hmm. CSV Conf. This is is it comma separated values conf?
It is. It is. In fact, it's CSV comma conf. Although I think the website is just csvconf.org, if I'm not mistaken. And it's run by some folks out of Portland and Berkeley. So I definitely recommend. It's not an annual conference. I'm not sure when their next edition will be, but I recommend folks who are interested in open data work to check it out.
That's very cool. I love that name. I think that's the coolest conference name I've heard since Notepad Conf. It's just like, cool.
Yeah. Notepad Conf. Pretty good.
Yeah. That sounds like a great name. Exactly. So, you're a data scientist, but, when I look at your LinkedIn, as we always do, we're always looking at each other's LinkedIns, I see that, I'm seeing background in math and not in programming. Do you identify as a programmer or how does a data scientist, a mathematician, and a programmer come together? What's that Venn diagram look like?
Yeah, the Venn diagram. So I am not a programmer, or at least I don't consider myself one. I have written programs, but it's sort of the same way that, you know, I have sung karaoke, but I would never consider myself a singer. It's sort of the analogy that I work with. So I have written programs, and in when you're working in data science, there's sort of this semantic exercise of what is data science that, that placates pretty much every conversation where two data scientists by whatever definition are together. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks say, you know, it's the overlap of domain expertise, computer science skills, and math and statistics skills. And that's totally true, which is why I am a recovering data scientist, but I am now management. because there are people who have, much better honed skills in the programming arena. And what I find that I bring to the table is the language component. It's the translation where I can speak, you know, business and legalese and securities and data and math. And I can speak programming even if I can't do it super well. I know the music theory behind it. I know the circle of fifths. I can't hold a pitch kind of thing.
Interesting. That makes me wonder. I should probably have a conductor or an orchestra person on the show sometime and find out if they know how to play a musical instrument or just,
oh, that'd be fascinating.
Know, just wave their arms in an appropriate way that works for everyone.
Exactly.
So when did you discover data science if you started out doing math?
You know, I discovered data science under that moniker probably around 2013. 2013, 2014 is when I learned of the word. It's sort of interesting when you talk to people, you know, what is accounting? What does an accountant do? You know, there's been accounting for probably hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. You know, lawyers, doctors, those are professions that if they're in an organization, you sort of know where they go. Data science, it's very recent. I think the first time that the word was used in print was in the late 50s in some military manual of some kind. Mm-hmm. So, So I heard the term very late in the game. At that point, I had already been, a professional nerd in some capacity for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And I learned of it when I was working in marketing, in programmatic marketing, after having spent almost a decade in strategy consulting. And so throughout, so my math degree, I employed it in all sorts of ways until I learned that I had some agency. I sort of felt like on a conveyor belt, I got recruited into very nice, jobs in investment banking and whatnot. And it just wasn't something that I felt passionate about. Mm-hmm. When I worked with the marketing data, it was so large. There was so much of it. It was, there were unstructured. And that's sort of at that point is when I learned the nomenclature and the jargon. And then that's when I decided this is the profession that I really want to go into. And so I did a couple of, I had a couple of roles after that, and then I went into management because programming a computer is really, really fun, but programming humans is really fun. And, you can pay somebody to keep a seat warm, but you can't pay somebody to think and solve a problem. They got to want it.
So you're as passionate about math and data science as you are about leadership and keeping people excited about their jobs.
I really am. I really am. I think that's where my Venn diagram of the things that I'm good at, the things that the world needs, and the things that I can get paid to do sort of overlap.
Would you call that kind of a non-traditional path into the tech industry and then becoming the director and the team lead of a group?
Into the tech industry, certainly. Into data science, no, because I'm not sure there exists a traditional path.
That's a good point. Hasn't been around long enough.
It really hasn't. And so it's, there are a couple of podcasts that I really like that I would, recommend to anybody interested in data science. Check out my Twitter feed. I usually talk about these things that I'm listening to. And there's a lot of gatekeeping that's starting to creep up in data science, which is annoying to me.
What do you mean by that, gatekeeping?
I mean by that folks who have, what they deem to be a traditional path because that's the breadth of experience that they've had, and they are confusing that with the normal distribution. And so they think that N of one or that N of five is the one true way. And so it usually has to do with, early access to math education or computer science or folks who had, parents or uncles or guides very early on who had PhDs and whatnot. When I graduated, nobody in my family has a PhD. And so I thought I really wanted to go down that route, but I had no idea, none whatsoever, even with the background that I did have, which was incredibly fortunate, right? I went to a really good school. Even then, I was sort of thrown to what's the next step? How does this work? Wait, what are grants? Do I pay for this? This is really expensive. I can't afford this kind of mentality. And so I think it's important to highlight that folks can get into it anyway. Mm-hmm. And these gatekeepers really need to think about how the folks who are listening to them are receiving that message.
That's interesting. Are you familiar with the fallacy of no true Scotsman?
Yes, that's exactly what this is.
Yeah. So for people who are listening who may not be familiar with that, it's this idea that you have some generalization, and the way that you poke at it or ruin it is by giving counterexamples. So someone says, and I can say this because I'm a Scotsman. My family's from Scotland. Someone says, no Scotsman puts sugar on his porridge. And makes a big generalization like that. And then someone else says, well, my uncle, Angus, he likes sugar in his porridge. And then they change the definition. Well, no true Scotsman puts sugar in his porridge. So the gatekeepers can do that with the definition of a data. No true data scientist does this, thereby changing the goalposts, as we say, and moving the finish line.
Right. And so if you haven't had, if you haven't mastered calculus, you couldn't possibly be able to appreciate or perform well in this mm-hmm. field. Oh, well, I meant, you know, I meant multivariate calculus. Well, no, I meant partial derivatives, and no, I meant linear algebra. And it just, there are all of these terms that they don't mm-hmm. mean a thing. I mean, nobody's storming the beaches of Normandy. You know, we are sitting yeah. in front of a computer and we're trying right. to get it to do something. We're trying to infer understanding from data. And so it's much more important to have an understanding of what that means from, mm-hmm. from the fact that data are just artifacts of processes. And so it's really important to understand the process that generated that data. Mm-hmm. You know, data isn't truth. Data is a version of truth that got captured in time. And so having that kind of understanding is much more important than the statistics, notwithstanding the fact that statistics are really important too. It's sort of statistics you can learn, but you also can learn about systems. There's not one thing that without which you can't succeed in the space.
Interesting. So that brings up in my mind an interesting question. You know, when we talk about like moral decisions, someone will say, well, the end justifies the means. And you had talked about how, you know, getting the result, that's, you know, success is a pretty good metric. If you write a program and the right answer pops out the other end, that's pretty successful, whether you're a non-traditional data scientist or not. You know, maybe back up a few years and your claim to fame and one of the things that you won an award for was something, a program that you wrote. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Yeah. So, it was a team effort. So I can't claim, a lot of the credit. But this was, several years back. It was the Edelman Award, for operations research in industry. And what mm-hmm. we did is, we were working with, a seed company, and they were just starting to use data, more intelligently. And so what they did is based on the data that they had gathered on how soybeans grew all over the world, you know, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, taking advantage of non-interrupted summers, all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make sure that at the end of the simulation, they would know how to plant their soybeans so that they had enough seed at the end of the whole process to supply the market. And so you don't want to have too much seed because if people aren't buying, then you have storage problems. I mean, there's all sorts of complications that we had to account for. And so I wrote this program. I didn't write this program. I duct taped this thing. Mm. And this is before Stack Overflow was a thing that I knew about. So, I cobbled it together and it got the right answer at the end. And that was actually the version that got submitted for evaluation. And to complete the whole calculation, it actually took something close to 24 hours.
Oh, wow.
Which is, this is running on a powerful, desktop computer. This is before cloud or anything. Right. And and then they brought in somebody who knows what they're doing, not in terms of understanding the systems and understanding the stats and the underlying math. You know, a lot of what I had to do is I had to fly to Minnesota and Iowa and talk to a lot of farmers and mm-hmm. really understand what it was that they were doing and extract that knowledge that was below their level of awareness. Right. I can't ask them these specific technical mathematical questions. They have no clue, right? I have to ask them, when do you plant and why? And why do you choose to plant it this way? And, in any case, so that was what my contribution was. But then afterwards, they brought somebody in who knows programming, who took all of that work that I had put together and actually, wrote it correctly. And now it runs in 3 minutes.
Oh my.
So that's why I don't think I'm a programmer.
Well, yeah, of course. But that definitely puts the whole kind of big O notation concept right in a very visceral way. I mean,
yes.
Somebody found your nested for loop and fixed it. But
yes.
At the same time, though, it did work. Other than the fact that it was slow, maybe we could have thrown more hardware at it and it would have happened in 3 minutes.
We certainly could. And again, this was in 2011, 2012. Mm-hmm. So this is a while back. And, mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, and this is something that I believe very strongly, this is what I spoke about when I went to CSVConf, is that there are all sorts of different dimensions within which we are excellent. But there are so many more dimensions that we are not excellent in. And what you want to do is you want to have teams of excellent people who have each other's backs, who cover each other's blind spots. And so you can try to find that one human who is really excellent at all the things that are important to you. But that A, that doesn't scale. B, things of importance aren't permanent. And those things also fluctuate. And that's why, you know, my having this awesome ability in one sense, you know, mathematically, but not having it in programming, which isn't something that I don't think I couldn't overcome. I just haven't dedicated the time. That's what I think when you put together a team that covers all of those spots, you just have such a much more resilient both product, but also roadmap, because your priorities now can change and you can adapt without giving up excellence.
So it sounds like, if I can put words in your mouth, you're probably against the idea of the rock star programmer or the unicorn that knows everything, the full stack developer who's an expert in everything.
So I do believe they exist. I'm not saying they don't exist.
Well, maybe they're not a strategy for team building, I guess, is what
But that's exactly what it is. I think there's this research, and I wish I would remember Amy Edmondson, I think. I may be misspelling her last name, mispronouncing it. But she did some research on this concept of super chickens. Have you heard of super chickens?
I have not, but I know that Amy Edmondson was a professor of leadership at Harvard and did a TED Talk.
Yes. And so I think it's her. I may be confusing them. So I'll send you the correct information to put on show notes. That way people can't not find the correct information because my memory is faulty. But anyway, super chickens is this concept. So the research was they put some chickens together and they measured their outcome by how many eggs they laid. And so they picked the best ones by this metric, and they started selecting the populations and creating these populations that were made up only of the best.
Okay.
And then they put together this hyper best population of only super chickens. And what ended up happening is that they all killed each other. So
okay.
I believe that there are these amazing programmers who can elevate the quality of the rest of the team as long as they don't have, you know, detrimental qualities of, you know, putting down other people, harassing people, being unethical, things that you shouldn't compromise, but some companies do for some reason. As long as those things aren't there, unicorns sure can elevate the rest of the team. But the problem is when you try to create a team of only unicorns. First of all, it's going to take you forever to staff because they're hard to find, and they are they know their worth. The second thing is going to be really expensive, because they know what their value is. It's part of what makes them a 10x or 100x, whatever. And but the other thing is that it tends to be highly correlated with an inflated sense of self-worth. So they may think that they're a 10x, but they act like they're a 50x, which causes all sorts of imbalances and all sorts of, you know, the juice ends up not being worth the squeeze.
Oh, interesting. You know, it makes me think about the times when you watch a movie and someone's trying to create a super soldier, and they always have like the Dungeons and Dragons card where it's like, we need maximum strength and maximum intelligence. But no one ever seems to optimize for niceness and team building, you know, when you're putting together a team full of super soldiers, you know?
Yeah.
Let's make sure that they're super nice and get along.
Yeah, my grandmother used to always say, which, you know, with the type of folks, the self-selection of folks who go into tech, this is highly relevant. She used to say that God has two cups, one of common sense and one of sort of street smart and one of book smart, and only so much water in the pitcher. And for every person, he either fills up the book smart, fills up the street smart, or there's a balance. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very true. There's a self-selection of folks who go into tech professions where they have a lot of book smart and not a lot of street smart, where knowing that, you know, building a strong coalition is important, mm-hmm. being resilient to strategy is important, and being kind. I don't know if being nice, but being kind, you know, kindness includes telling somebody that they've stepped over the line. Mm-hmm. Kindness includes telling somebody, hey, I noticed that you have this gap in your knowledge. Here's how you can fix that. And kindness means being able to welcome that feedback.
It would be nice if kindness were more appreciated in tech. Sometimes this is something I've been a proponent of for many years, and I feel like people believe that being nice or being kind is a form of weakness. And, you know, if one were to be excellent, like, let's let Linus be Linus. You know, he doesn't have to be pleasant. He's, you know, talk is cheap. Show me the code, right? It doesn't matter if he, you know, said it with 12 F words and insulted a whole class of people while he was doing the source code commit.
That's insane to me, because there are so many intangibles in mm-hmm. that equation. Just the code works, sure, but how much are you going to have to pay out in health insurance because everybody needs a therapist, or because everybody's immune system is compromised because they're so stressed? You know, these are actual impactful to the bottom line numbers mm-hmm. that just somehow get brushed under the carpet as, well, those don't matter because of X, Y, and Z, right? And that's where the kindness comes in. Kindness is a muscle, right? Mm-hmm. You can exercise it. You can prioritize it. And it has tangible impacts to the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we don't want these super chickens killing everyone on the team. I did find the information on that. It was Margaret Heffernan talked about super chickens in a TED Talk, and the experiment itself was named by a geneticist named William Muir.
William Muir, that's right. Yeah. So there's another something interesting from Amy, which I think is the TED Talk that you mentioned.
Right.
That I also bring up in my talk. Those two studies I think are really interesting.
Right. So between Amy Edmondson
And Margaret Heffernan and
Margaret Heffernan, you've got a pretty good bunch of research into egos and equality and leadership and how those things fit in.
Right, and how to create sustainable, high-performant teams that don't break the bank, right? Like, this is moneyballing.
Yeah, it is. Well, how do you also not break your engineers when, like, for example, if you tell someone to get some piece of work done or you assign them some task, does it matter to you if you, for example, discovered after the fact that that person worked 16 hours for 3 days and was up all night and missed their child's birthday, did it all silently, though, without complaint, to get the job done? And then, you know, months later, you discover that they've been killing themselves to get that work done.
I think that's why there's 7 billion of us. Right? There are different clocks and different folks march to a different drummer. So what I would do is I would go to this person and try to make it abundantly clear that they understood that that was not required, neither required nor expected. Mm-hmm. But if there's, you know, and if they want to make that up otherwise so that, you know, now they can go on a vacation that isn't an extra couple of days longer, and we'll work it out with HR and we'll figure something out to offset mm-hmm. it or to ensure that they're not burning out. I might recommend that they go, you know, take a couple of days off, go play a video game. Who cares, right? Mm-hmm. But if they don't want that and they didn't feel that that was expected and that was just this internal drive that they have because they wanted to deliver the best and they knew they could do it, that's great. You know, I'm not going to tell anybody. Folks have agency. I'm not going to tell anybody.
Right. We're all adults, is what you're saying.
You know, I'm not going to tell you how to apportion your time. I'm not going to ask. Right. I'm not going to ask you to keep the seat warm.
Right.
I have absolutely no desire to see folks from 9 to 5. As long as the things that we sign up to do get accomplished, as long as we're not dropping any balls or leaving anyone behind, if we had the chance to help another team and we're not taking that chance, I think that's a little icky. Otherwise. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard though. I was getting into an argument with someone online recently when I made what I thought was a non-controversial statement about how important work-life balance was and for us all to remember why we work. And there was a whole thread on Twitter a couple of days ago where people were talking about, well, there is no work-life balance. It was some San Francisco VC type.
I think I saw that, yeah.
You saw that. And he was like, there's only work-life integration. And I'm like, really? Are we going to the dictionary now and just picking words? You can call it whatever you want, but there's only 24 hours in a day.
And that feels so prescriptivist. It feels so presumptive to know.
Well, it's a big old declarative statement. Thou shalt.
It's the one true Scotman, right? Which only work-life integration, nothing else. Well, no, that's what works for some folks, not for everyone. And who am I to know what works best for you, Scott, or what works best for anyone? I know what works best for me. And I make that work for me. But if somebody else doesn't want to have work-life balance, that's, you know, I will try to figure out if there's something that is coming from a place of pain, or if it's coming from a place of ignorance, or if it's coming from a place of insecurity. But mm-hmm. as long as none of those things, to the best of my ability, are there, folks can do what they want. They can have a balance where they work only 9 to 5 and they shut their phone off. Or mm-hmm. they can come in at 10:30 and leave at 3:30, and then, you know, for 3 months straight, they leave at midnight because that's how their brain works. As mm-hmm. long as nobody is burning out, which, again, it's not purely altruistic, right? Like, this is going to have a negative impact that's going to ripple through my teams. Mm-hmm. So you know, if I do think that requiring everyone to act a certain way takes away their autonomy, and nothing good comes from that.
Yeah. It's definitely, that is one of the blessings of being in the tech industry, is for most people, unless you're at a 9-to-5 kind of cube farm, which I know some of my listeners are, and I spent many years doing that. For the most part, we do have a certain amount of autonomy in the sense of there's core hours, there's get your job done, and you can work from home or take a Friday off. And things like that. And that's why we'd like to see more people get into the tech industry. They can be productive and possibly have some amount of work-life balance.
Right. And it's all about shared expectations. I think if everybody has signed on to the plan, that's great. But if one person sort of doesn't deliver on the expectations of the team, then something's broken. Right. Like, it's all about that balance, and it's all about being kind to your teammates and making sure that you're meeting their expectations so that when you expect things from them, that's returned.
Mm-hmm. What are a couple of tips that you can maybe offer as we get towards the end of the show here about helping others to break into not only the tech industry, but also maybe get interested in data science if they know how to say the words, but they maybe don't know what the right direction, if they want to go into that direction of technology?
Yeah, so you can always find me on Twitter. I'm happy to answer questions. I'm also happy to broadcast any work that anybody has done. So if you have a blog post of some analysis that you've done, and you want to reach a bigger audience, let me know and I'll signal boost. And if you're interested in just learning a little bit more, there are some really great resources, but one of my favorites is the Becoming a Data Scientist podcast, which has interviews with lots of folks, none of whom really have a traditional background. So it's really interesting to see the different paths that folks took into the field. I also really like Partially Derivative, the podcast, and both of those podcasts also have very robust websites backing them with lots of tools and trainings and links to the big world of data science.
And even though when we go to these places and see that people have PhDs or advanced degrees from advanced places, should we still persist?
Oh my gosh, yeah. So first off, I don't have a PhD, and I did actual real data science work and got compensated for it. So I was a professional.
That is the goal, right?
Right. And the other thing is my team, of all the folks that, that are in my team right now, it's about a 50-50 of PhDs, non-PhDs. Mm-hmm. Which I think is also important because it sort of brings this really interesting mix of folks who don't have baked in assumptions, and it forces us to think through things, rather than just default to the training. Mm-hmm. And yeah, absolutely. You don't need a PhD to become a data scientist or to be successful in it.
Right. And just like you don't need to be a singer to do karaoke and be somewhat successful at it.
Exactly. That's very exactly cool. It.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Scott. This has been really, really great. I appreciate the opportunity to geek out and share a little bit of the empiricism love.
Absolutely my pleasure. This was Angela Bassa. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.